KPFK's end-of-year drive starts on Giving Tuesday, December 2nd. Help us secure 500 new and sustaining members. Be ready to sign up for as little as $5 a month and power the voices of independent and free speech radio. Can KPFK count on you? Help us hit 500 members between now and the end of the year. Call 818-985-5735, option 2, or visit kpfk.org/donate for more information.
You can count on me like 1, 2, 3, I'll be there.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're tuned to 90.7 FM KPFK. Radio powered by the people. 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, 98.7, Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. Peace!
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
A teenager was freed yesterday after 9 months in an Israeli prison. Mohammed Ibrahim, a 16-year-old from Florida, was released following a guilty plea and a suspended sentence, according to The Guardian. His family says he was taken to a hospital for intravenous therapy and blood work immediately after release, and noted that he had lost a quarter of his body weight and was still suffering from scabies contracted during his detention. Ibrahim was arrested in a raid on his family's West Bank home in February when he was still 15, with Israeli forces allegedly blindfolding and handcuffing him in the middle of the night. He was charged with 2 counts of throwing objects at moving vehicles. Ibrahim's case first gained attention after his older cousin, 20-year-old American-Palestinian Saifullah Musallat, was allegedly beaten to death by Israeli settlers in mid-July. While reporting on that story, reporters for The Guardian learned that Ibrahim had been held since February. According to a 2013 UNICEF report, Israel is the only country in the world that systematically prosecutes children in military courts. Between 2005 and 2010, 835 Palestinian minors aged 12 to 17 were tried on stone-throwing charges in military court, with only one acquitted. According to the most recently available data, around 350 Palestinian children between the ages of 12 and 17 are currently being held in Israeli military detention. Israeli forces have raided a village in southern Syria, killing at least 13 people, according to Syrian officials. Syria's foreign ministry described the attack as a, quote, horrific massacre, stating that women and 2 children were among the dead. Israeli forces said they acted on intelligence to apprehend suspects from the Jama Islamiyah in Beit Jin. They entered the village to arrest the suspected local men and opened heavy fire after being confronted by residents. Najat Rochdi, the United Nations Deputy Special Envoy for Syria, condemned Israel's attack, saying the deaths and displacement of Syrian civilians constituted a grave and unacceptable violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, adding that Israel's actions are, quote, further destabilizing an already fragile environment. Rochdi called for the immediate cessation of territorial violations and adherence to the 1974 disengagement agreement between Israel and Syria, which Israel has argued is void since the removal of former President Bashar al-Assad last year. People who work with refugees are worried about backlash after authorities say an Afghan national shot National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C. this week. Ramnullah Lakhanwal drove from his home in Washington State and shot 2 West Virginia National Guard members deployed in Washington, one of whom, Specialist Sarah Beckstrom, died of her injuries on Thursday. The other, Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf, remains hospitalized in critical condition. Lakhanwal, entered the U.S. in 2021 through Operation Allies Welcome, a Biden administration program that evacuated and resettled roughly 76,000 Afghans after the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from the country, officials said. McConwell applied for asylum during the Biden administration, but his asylum was approved during the Trump administration. Hashtag Afghan Evac, a San Diego-based group that helps resettle Afghans who assisted with the U.S. military, said in a statement. Prior to his arrival in the United States, McConwell worked with the U.S. government, including the CIA, quote, as a member of a partner force in Kandahar, according to CIA Director John Ratcliffe. Sean Van Diver, president of Afghan Evac, said many Afghans living in the U.S. are afraid to leave their houses, fearing they'll be swept up by immigration officials or attacked with hate speech, saying, quote, they're terrified. It's insane. People are acting xenophobic because of one deranged man. He doesn't represent all Afghans. He represents himself. Janine Pirro, the U.S. attorney for Washington, D.C., said it was, quote, too soon to say what the suspect's motives were. Following Wednesday's shooting, the Trump administration announced it will re-examine green card holders from 19 countries. President Donald Trump posted a tirade on social media Thursday night, saying he wants to, quote, permanently pause immigration from foreign nations, and promising to expel millions of immigrants from the United States by revoking their legal status. He blamed immigrants for problems from crime to housing shortages as part of social dysfunction in America and demanded, quote, reverse migration. The president wrote that, quote, most foreign-born U.S. residents are on welfare from failed nations or from prisons, mental institutions, gangs, or drug cartels. Even as a 2023 study by economists found that immigrants are 60% less likely to be charged with a crime than people born in the U.S. Immigrants have been imprisoned at lower rates for nearly 150 years, the study found. Joseph Edlow, head of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, said the president had directed him to conduct a full-scale, rigorous re-examination of every green card for every alien from every country of concern. I'm Jacques Labarger-Martel for Pacifica Radio.
Those were today's headlines from Pacifica Radio. Today on Sojourner Truth, we speak with Pete White about our attacks on our unhoused neighbors on Skid Row in Los Angeles and why we should all be engaged in the battle to support and build power for our unhoused neighbors, followed by Victor Naro on the state of the war on immigrants in Los Angeles, the state of California, and in this country, and why we ain't buying it from Black Friday through Cyber Monday. And we remember Imam Jamil al-Amin, formerly known as H-Rap Brown. All this and more on Sojourner Truth Radio after this short music break.
Is it hard to keep me out your thoughts? Distracting from your plots. You can't afford to spend the time. But I can tell you wanna know me well. Come fall under my spell and I'll make sure you're satisfied.
Madison McFerrin. Ain't it nice? Gotta bring some smooth, some joy, some something to refresh and to recharge as we look at the battles that we have ahead. As we head into what is supposed to be a holiday season of peace on earth and goodwill towards mankind, it seems the attacks on our unhoused neighbors are intensifying on the federal, the state, and the local level. I'm pleased to be joined by my brother comrade Pete White to get some clarity on what our unhoused neighbors are facing at this moment in the Skid Row neighborhood of Los Angeles, as well as in the state and across the country. Pete White is the executive director of the Los Angeles Community Action Network, also known as LA CAN. I'm so glad you were able to pop in with us today, Pete. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's always good to be on with you. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you great. Thank you so very much. So you and LA Can have been supporting and building power with our unhoused neighbors on Skid Row for decades now. But for those who may not be aware, who is LA Can and what is the work that you all do and have been doing so well during this time?
Yeah, so LA Can is the Los Angeles Community Action Network. We've been based in downtown since 1994. Our three leading strategies is community power building, community service, and community improvement. And under the power building wing, that's where you're getting us building power with and amongst folks who are both unhoused and precariously housed. Let's be clear that people oftentimes move between the station of being unhoused to housed and then unhoused again, because many of the ways in which policies work or don't work on their behalf. Some of the other things that we've done that people, of course, know as well for direct action, impact litigation, and, you know, our cultural work. We had the Freedom Singers on AGT and other things, right? Because we believe that it's important to be freedom singers as well as freedom swingers at the same time. You know what I mean? So that's who LA Can is. But I just want to be really clear. When we talk about our organization, we're an anti-poverty organization. And so in our base, we have houseless folks. We have precariously housed folks. We have immigrants in our folks. We have whoever is in our community is who we represent. And oftentimes, most likely, those are poor people of color.
That's really important. And I'm glad that you raised it, because it was the next thing that I wanted us to talk about is, you know, the demographics, both in terms of who we're talking about on the conversations of the intersections with race, with gender, with, you know, queerness, with migrant status, et cetera, but also who we're talking about in terms of working, non-working, right? Because yep. There is a notion that people have, right? That when we're talking about unhoused people, that we're talking about people who, they look a certain way. They clearly are not working and don't want to work, right? All of those tropes, right? They're on drugs, or they suffer from mental disease that can never be cured or addressed. Like, there's like a broad swath, but basically it's the people that are disposable. But give us a sense of who's being thrown into that disposable category.
And that's why I love being on the show. I think that's really, really important. You know, for the most part, policy has dictated us to believe that houselessness only shows up for folks who are Black primarily or brown, right? They've led us to believe that folks are houseless because of their substance abuse addiction or their mental illness, right? They will have you believe that the streets are teeming with folks because Ronald Reagan shut down the psychiatric hospitals, all of which are myths, right? In the city of Los Angeles, 78% of those who are houseless, right, are houseless for one of three reasons: housing affordability, housing availability, and poverty, right? Those are the leading drivers of houselessness, right? The next thing is, if we really think that folks are houseless because of their addiction, all of America would be houseless, right? Because when you think about those addicted to all sorts of drugs, right? Prescription drugs and non-prescription drugs, right? America is addicted, but America isn't on the streets. What really drives the crisis, what has always driven the crisis, the economy drives the crisis, deindustrialization, particularly for the Black community, drives the crisis for us, the unavailability of services. And when you think about houselessness in any city, but we're talking about Los Angeles, it's generally manufactured by the city. The other myth that we've heard, is that houseless people all come from somewhere else, right? In reality, 80% of those who are houseless come not just from the city and the towns that they're in, but oftentimes from the communities in which we see them houseless, or we find our neighbors houseless, right? Because of gentrification, because people are driven from their homes, because, you know, 60% of South Central Los Angeles rental stock is now held by corporations, right? Like all of these things, and without real solid leadership that's stopping the pattern of abuse and takings in our community, will continue to grow. And then the last thing I'll say is for the listeners, if you got, you know, if you got somebody, if you living on Big Mama couch, right, and you don't know where you're going to go, right, if you're tripling up, quadrupling up in your property and you don't have a lease and you don't know where you're going to go, if you lose that property, you too are houseless, right? And so they also have in our minds that houselessness is just people living in informal settlements or people you see on the streets. But houselessness are students going to USC, living in their cars, right? It's us, it's folks in our family doubling up and tripling up in single rooms trying to shelter themselves, right? And so we've got to broaden the aperture when we think about poverty and houselessness and precarity in this city and globally, as you stated at the top of the hour.
Absolutely. And I think about that precarity and just the so many the intersections. And I want to go to this manufacturing conversation that you raised. But just, you know, when you were talking, it brought into my mind this sister from Ethiopia who ended up literally dying in her car, living in her car. But she was going to work every day for the Walt Disney. You know what I mean? The happiest place on earth. Right.
Right. Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right
yeah,
there. Right there.
Right there. You know what I mean? So the thoughts that people have and how people end up in the space, right? Because, in you know, for Black immigrant community, people are embarrassed. They don't want to let people know they don't have a place to stay. They may not have anyone, right, that can support them. They're Black, so they still are dealing with discrimination. Like, there's so many factors that were something other than, oh, you know, she want to live on the streets. Hey, that's because
No, absolutely right. And, you know, the other thing, Nano, which is important, you know, for a number of decades, Dan Fleming and the Economic Roundtable wrote about this thing that talks about the corridors of poverty, right? And those corridors of poverty stretch from South Central Los Angeles into downtown Los Angeles. What most people don't realize is that South Central Los Angeles was an industrial hub, right? The steel industry was there. The rubber industry was there, right? And so when those industries were there, I'm not going to say everything was peaches and cream, but there were opportunities. There were more opportunities for Black Angelenos and Brown Angelenos, but first and foremost, Black Angelenos. But with deindustrialization, folks started losing their jobs, started losing their homes, and they started going down that corridor of poverty, right? And so moving from South Central, many folks into downtown for one reason. That one reason is because the housing stock was cheaper in downtown Los Angeles. Those big hotels that people see are more like apartment buildings. Those are residential hotels, right? And so people were living in these hotels for decades upon decades because of being driven from South Central Los Angeles. Now, in 2025, you see informal settlements all across the city. Right. You like it used to be defined as downtown and South Central. Now, Pacific Palisades, Venice, like you name it, you will see an informal settlement. That's because when we talk about manufacturing, that's because the housing crisis has reached the entire city. Right. And so when people see folks out in Venice, right, those folks are from Venice. And it's interesting. A lot of people didn't or don't know that pre-COVID, we were already about 500,000 units short of housing that's affordable to all Angelenos, right? And when we talk about 500,000 units, that ain't people, that's units, right? And so 500,000 units is roughly like 1.2 million people who were struggling and who were on the precipice of if they just lost a job, because, you know, it takes us two or three jobs to afford housing in Los Angeles. If they lost one of those jobs, they could for sure wind up houseless, right, with nowhere to go. And during the time post-COVID, there are a lot of studies being done, because we were talking about the eviction cliff. Why was there eviction cliff? Because folks didn't realize that when the federal government stopped folks from having to pay rent, they were going to have to pay that rent back. And no one really had the $60,000, $70,000, and $80,000, oftentimes $80,000 worth of rent and back pays, right, across the city. And so you started seeing Angelenos becoming a little bit more sensitive to the issues of houselessness. How is that? You started seeing them saying things like, yes, we want the ADU law passed. Yes, we don't mind a shelter in our community as long as it's like a mile away, but we don't mind if it's in our community, right? And the reason that the reason that there was this shift, it wasn't because people's kindness in their hearts shifted. It was because the proximity to the issues shifted. Everyone began to know someone who was either houseless or were on the verge of becoming houseless. And that's what made people say, yeah, well, wait a second. Maybe we should think about this in a whole nother way. Now we're running into the Olympics, which is probably going to be something we'll talk about in the next segment, which is going to bring a lot of drama for a whole lot of people. But that's some of the things and some of the background when we think about like the contemporary crisis that we're facing. And there's a few other things, but I'll let you get in real quick, Nana.
Thank you. You're listening to Sojourner Truth Radio with your co-host Nana Jumphy, and I'm speaking with Pete White, Executive Director of LA CAN, Los Angeles Community Action Network. All right, I have a lot to fit into this 10 minutes here, Pete. Okay, so I want to talk about the grabbing of people's belongings, just this theft of people's homes. And belongings is so disturbing, especially in this time. I'm thinking about, it's always disturbing, but in this past 3 weeks, we have had storms that people knew were coming and they just tearing people's tents down, tearing people's homes down, grabbing people's stuff. We have the holiday season coming up. Had a sister chef, because we have so much talent that is in Skid Row neighborhood, a chef who does like a Thanksgiving spread. They came, took her stuff, grabbed everything, just didn't care. You know, let's talk about that. How is this happening? This does not sound like safe inside or inside safe or whatever that's supposed to be. What is happening?
I mean, there's a couple of things happening. Let me first talk about the sister, Chef Bless. The interesting thing, and this is where we talk about the manufacturing. So now you have Chef Bless, who's houseless, who got on the bus every day, went to culinary school in Santa Monica, got the certificates to prove it. But then additionally went the next step, went through Mayor Karen Bass's LEAF program. And the LEAF program is just a program for entrepreneurs to be able to do the things that she's doing, right? To be a street vendor, right? Got all of those certificates. And so she's literally on the street, houseless, operating a business, right? Because she's an entrepreneur. She's a street vendor. And she has all of her wares taken. So everything that she needs to get the money that she needs to get off the streets are just swept away. She has every certificate that she needs. She's met every measure that the city or the state has said, this is what you need to do to be able to work your craft. And still, in a blink of an eye, right, came and targeted her, left other folks alone and targeted specifically her, right? And so this is where I say, on the one hand, you have lip service and you have rhetoric like, yes, we are here for all Angelenos, and these are the ways and these are the tools we have for them. But then when Angelenos attempt to play by the rules that are laid out in front of them, as questionable as some of those rules are, the rule book or the playbook changes in the middle of the stream. And so now Chef Bless, who is, and you know, she's getting prepared to cook a meal, a real meal, because she's like, yo, we don't want any of that Campbell's 3D bioengineered meat down here. Like, we want to cook some ackee and saltfish. We want to do some rice and peas. We want to actually feed the people. She has all of her goods taken from her, right? So not only is she attempting to build a business, but she's also at the same time doing what Queen Biddy Mason did, right? Queen Biddy Mason, she walks all the way here from Oklahoma as a midwife, gets here, fights for her freedom, opens up the first shelter system, the first general store, which provides credit and which provided credit in downtown Los Angeles. So this sister doing the same exact thing as her and is criminalized and penalized for it. And as you said, yes, you know, there's on the books in Los Angeles, if there's rain in the forecast, they're supposed to leave houseless people alone. If the temperatures are dropping, as they oftentimes do, because people forget we're in the desert, they're supposed to leave houseless people's properties alone. But what we're seeing is an uptick of theft. And this is absolutely what it is, right? And we've sued and we've won before, but because we're suing and winning, the city doesn't really care. They're like, sue us because it's the taxpayers' money anyway. They continue to steal people's properties. But in stealing people's property, they're also stealing people's lives, right? 7 people per day are dying in the city of Los Angeles who are houseless. 7 people per day, right? Think about it. That's audacious. 7 people per day, right? And now, on top of that, we have, you know, we have a new convention center. Now, we defeated the old convention center. We have a new convention center that they're proposing to build, and they being CCA, you know, the oldest business organization in downtown Los Angeles, right? And in this convention center, I don't know if the listeners know or not, but our controller, Kenneth Mejia, has informed us that we will be paying $118 million per year for the next 30 years to actually pay for this convention center. What most people don't know, AEG, you know, an entertainment giant, is part of the building of the convention center, but also 2 of the members of CCA, they also, who are going to build the convention center, they also build jails and detention centers, right? And so you have these builders that are going to be building in downtown that we're all applauding, right? That labor is coming out and applauding, and also understanding that these same people are trying to build care first jails in Los Angeles and detention centers. And so when we think about camps, when we think about informal settlements, when we think about sort of the Olympics coming, they are straight up trying to Operation Hammer Black and brown communities out of existence, right? They are trying to get us out of sight and out of mind. And I know you have Victor coming on, but it becomes important for us, and this is why we love rocking with Baji. It becomes important for us to really talk about the connections, as you did, as you brought me in, the connections between all of the communities, right? At the times in which we attempt to silo ourselves, we are not siloed in the oppressor's vision, right? Like, the same people, again, who are building our convention center, are building jails, and are building detention camps. And this is the ways in which Los Angeles is moving, right? Without us on the ground pushing back. And I know Angelenos are going to continue to push back.
Absolutely. And thank you for making those connections. And I wish I had another like 20 minutes, but I do want to bring Victor in as well and talk about, and we'll carry some of this theme into that conversation. But thinking about the pushing back, right? And we definitely got to have you back on. Like, let's do this again, like in a couple of weeks.
100%.
Even if we got to pre-record, let's make it happen, because it's really important. What does that pushing back look like? Because I am so fired up and ready to go. And I'm hoping other people who are listening are like, yo, what do we need to do to make it happen, to be able to be, one in that number that is really pushing back on behalf of ourselves, right? It's like, you know, they say we're saving our own lives. Like, this is not pity party charity piece. No, this is us. You know, we have to show that we got us. How do we do that?
I mean, there's a number of things, and a lot of these things are happening in Los Angeles already. One of the things are we are going to have to become active witnesses. And so when people are being swept from our streets, whether that's being kidnapped by ICE or swept by sanitation and the LAPD, we have got to stand in between these forces. We have got to say, we have got to have the questions. We cannot simply allow folks to traipse in our communities and pull us out, right? The next thing that we're electing, you know, when we think, you know, folks are feeling like the Mamdani flow across the country. But the thing that becomes most important, whether it's in New York or in Los Angeles, when you elect your friends, you have got to keep your foot on the gas with your friends as well, right?
They're still the ops.
And so it becomes important to understand that just because if we're engaging in electoral work, it is important to put them in, but it is even more important to hold them accountable. Because many of the things that we are hearing right now, Nana, and I'm laughing because there is no way that you and I are going to finish in the next 10 seconds. But many of the things that we're hearing right now that feel Trump-like are things that folks in Los Angeles have been rocking Trump-like for like the last couple of years, right? And so... Right. We cannot check out ever. We've got to check in, right? And then you could always get down with LA Can. We got a gang of trainings. We have community watch trainings. We see our work. We're headquartered in Skid Row, but our work is citywide, countywide, nationwide, in many respects. And so you can get at us. We're on all of our socials. It's LA Can Network. And that's the way you find us.
Absolutely. Please do so, folks. I'm going to be, you know, I'm already in that number, as you said, Baji, Black Alliance for Just Immigration. We already walking together, right? But we know that we need to elevate that even more. I'm going to share with you later, Pete, and with, you know, some of these listeners, the Stop Taking Our People frame that Baji's working on to deal with the invasion of the body snatchers and of the property snatchers, apparently. Thank you so much for coming on. Really, really appreciate you, Pete.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful rest of your night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Pete White, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Community Action Network, also known as LA Can. We're going to have more Sojourner Truth with our good brother comrade, Victor Naro, after this station break.
Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Supreme reign over the universe. Om Shanti.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth Radio, and you are here with co-host Nana Jumpfy, wanting to let you know and to take just a few minutes to remember Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, formerly known as H. Rep. Brown. Imam Jamil was a political prisoner twice incarcerated in New York on false charges of an armed robbery in the 1970s, and then again in 2002 for the death of a Fulton County sheriff deputy in Atlanta, Georgia. He passed away just this week, November 23rd, while in prison on that conviction. As an imam and leader in the Islamic community, he was a one-time chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Minister of Justice for the Black Panther Party. Imam Jamil, a civil rights activist and a devout Muslim, remained a target of COINTELPRO and U.S. police agencies until his recent death. Let's listen to this quick clip of an interview he did before his arrest in Georgia.
As the Constitution has stated it, being created equal. And so therefore, it was that whole sense of self-worth that had been instilled within us, you know, from when we were young. And that although society and the rules of society at that time, you know, had a situation whereby there was not the balance or the equality amongst the races, we still had some sense of the self-worth that was very important in terms of having the consciousness of developing the attitude for struggle.
Do you remember your first experience with what we might call prejudice? Remember a time that it sort of struck you that things weren't fair?
Even before any particular incident occurred, you know, it was constantly pounded into you that there was a difference. You know, again, the schools, the parks, the transportation facilities, everything, you know, amplified the fact that there was a sense of disparity between groups of people. So it's not, I can't call any particular incident that made me any more aware of the institution as it was being practiced than the fact of the environment itself.
You think it was your brother then who said, we don't have to go along with this, you know, we can do something about this? Was he the one who first gave you that idea?
No, I don't think it would be fair in terms of an assessment to individualize as to any one particular individual, because the nature of struggle itself is that it is an ongoing process. It did not begin in the 50s or the 60s. If our analysis of struggle is that it began in the 50s or 60s, then one could reason that it ended in the 70s. But when the first slave rebelled against being enslaved, he gave an alternative to slavery that was built upon. So that whole sense of struggle had been imbued, had been instilled within the people who had been dealt with unjustly in this situation. And when it is referred to the Quran, as Allah has said in Quran, tyranny and oppression is worse than slaughter. Fight them wherever you may find them. It is a kind of a sense of awareness that when people have been dealt with unjustly, that there is a sense of struggle against that injustice.
But as a young man, there had to be a moment in which the idea entered your mind, because not everybody fought back, you know. It's true that you can see a long arc of rebellion, but not everyone participates. Something had to trigger you to participate.
Well, people participate on different levels. We, even before my brother had been expelled from Southern University, we had gone out with the intention of voter registration from the YMCA. You know, we were members of the YMCA. We had undertaken an effort at voter registration. This is when I was, you know, maybe 12 or 13 years old. So, again, that consciousness of having to do something, having to be active, you know, was a thing that was a part and parcel of the time itself. Mm-hmm. It wasn't independent of the time. It's not like we issued in a new age or anything like that. No, we were a part of, and we were byproducts of, that sense of movement that had been introduced into struggle.
That was Imam Jamil Al-Amin, one-time chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, and the Minister of Justice for the Black Panther Party, talking about that arc of struggle that comes from understanding the movement. We will be speaking with our comrade Victor Naro after this short music break.
Soak the smoke from me as you dream inside. Let your day slip away, come with me and ride.
And had to get some funk in. You are listening to Sojourner Truth Radio with co-host Nana Jumphy, and that was D'Angelo, the great, peace be unto him, with the song Ain't That Easy, and we know that it ain't that easy. Glad to be joined right now by my brother comrade, Victor Nottle. Victor Nottle is the project director and labor studies professor for the UCLA Labor Center and core faculty for the Public Interest Law and Policy Program of UCLA School of Law. Great to speak with you, Brother Victor.
Thank you, Nana. Can you hear me okay?
Can hear you great. Can hear you great. You know, there's so much happening. There is so much happening, and just thinking, every time the regime gives me reasons to rearrange my questions. Okay, so let's talk about what has happened with this last piece by the head of the regime, who is now, you know, he just fires stuff off. Unfortunately, people follow what he fires. By firing off, banning folks from all foreign nations, reverse immigration, basically trying to push back, you know, pull back up a post 9/11 fervor against folks from Afghanistan, but just against folks generally. And we have this coming right now, right? Right as we have the invasion of the body snatchers, as I described them, happening in an intense way, really all across the country. So first, just your reaction to what the regime is putting out, you know, scapegoating immigrants, scapegoating Afghans, and, you know, talking about and giving reason for the increased criminalization of us all.
Well, there's a lot of, as you know, this president's full of lies and misinformation and attacks. That, you know, the asylum application process, the vetting process for those Afghan refugees are being done by his administration. They were not done by the Biden administration. He's using this one incident not just to send 500 more National Guard troops to D.C., but also now he's going after 19 countries. He's going after immigrants from 19 countries. He wants to check everybody's green card application process from those 19 countries. And it's an example of his increasing attacks of anybody who's brown skin or black skin, anybody who's immigrant in this country, any person of color is under attack by this president. And this is the latest example. But we're fighting back. I mean, we saw what's happening in Charlotte this past week. Young people, you know, not just older generation activists, but young people are fighting back hard against ICE. We saw in Chicago, the fight back in Chicago, the resistance, not just from community members and activists, but from, you know, people in general, people who don't want the presence of ICE in their cities, people who don't like what's being done to their neighbor immigrants and immigrant families. And then, you know, we've been seeing that again in Los Angeles. And I do agree with Peter. I mean, I was so grateful to hear Peter just now, but I do agree with Peter that if there's a time to be more intersectional and break the silos, is today, because one thing we do have in common is this president's attacking every one of us. And an attack on immigrants is also an attack on Black community. An attack on the unhoused is also an attack of all of us. So this is where we really need to be intersectional and break down the silos. So I really give a shout out to Peter for reminding me of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, you know, we talk about this, and I think one of the things that this regime is doing is, if there's a question that any group of people have, why is this my fight? or is this my fight? And you recall, right, that at the beginning of this year, when this regime first came in, people were actually having those kinds of questions, right? It's like, should I jump in? Why am I jumping in? You know, this doesn't have anything to do with my people or my community or my neighborhood or my, you know, social class or whatever thoughts people had, particularly Black folks, people of color, including other immigrants, right? So we're not even saying this is just something that was a USian thing or a citizen thing, right? It was something, or US citizen thing, something that people were doing so often was really trying to separate themselves in an effort to separate themselves from what they thought were the targets. And I think this regime's actions are making it clearer that we are all the targets. And so I want to talk a little bit about that in some categories. So first, I want to talk about this We Ain't Buying It campaign, which I think is an example of different groups coming together. So you had the attack that came from Target and other corporations on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and this boycott Target that came out of that, which most people associate with Black community. And then you had this push around Home Depot to boycott Home Depot or get away from Home Depot based upon what was happening, what we all saw with our eyes of Home Depot allowing the body snatchers to chase people down the aisleways and to grab people in the parking lots. You see folks that are looking at what's happening with labor and looking at folks like Amazon and Starbucks, and everyone is coming together in this We Ain't Buying It. And you know, as a labor, a folks that the person that's an expert in the labor area and the migration area, talking about race, bring that all together for us.
Well, you know, I've always been out of the position. I've made this clear in your the previous programs that if you look the other way, if you're one of these major businesses, one of these major corporations like Home Depot, like Target, like Starbucks, and you look the other way when you see witness exploitation of your workers, exploitation of customers, exploitation of day laborers that's connected to your business, you look the other way, you are complicit. You are actively complicit in the process because you are not taking a stand. You are not taking a position. And I think this is what ties us all together now. Starbucks, you know, they've been trying to, the courageous workers at Starbucks have been trying to get a union contract for such a long time. And they instead have received a lot of unfair labor practices against them, retaliation, you know, firings and all kinds of violations. So now they're on the streets throughout the country asking us to boycott Starbucks. We see it at the Home Depot. Home Depot is complacent. The owner, the family owns Home Depot, a major Trump supporter. They donated millions of dollars to the Trump campaign. They are complacent. The Amazon, as we know, Amazon is one of the most notorious anti-worker, anti-union major corporation in this country. Jeff Bezos and Trump are like, you know, they're like such good friends.
Bosom buddies.
So, and then we see it with Target. You know, we see it with all these business establishments. And one way we fight back is not to do business, not to give them their business. You know, because They make their profits off of us. They make their profits off the consumer base. One of the largest consumer base in this country is the immigrant community. So the consumerism is huge. We can use the power of consumerism to fight back. In addition to the protests, in addition to the, you know, the massive nonviolence resistance, we can also choose as a community not to patronize these establishments, not to give them business.
Yeah, and I think it's important that we talk about the connections, right? Because when we're looking at all of these various communities or people that we're bringing in, stakeholders that we're talking about, like Black community, again, regardless of citizenship, huge buying power. Immigrant community, again, regardless of citizenship or home country, huge buying power. Workers, right? Huge buying power, and workers, of course, is going to cut across race. It's going to cut across gender, sexual orientation, all of that, right? And when we look, it's like we are buying things from and supporting these corporations who are literally taking their money and using their money to harm us, right?
Yes, and as Peter mentioned, a lot of these corporations are connected with the very oppressive systems as harmonizers. A lot of them are connected with private companies that create detention centers. A lot of them are connected in so many ways with the oppressive systems as harmony immigrants today. And they're very connected with this president, a lot of these huge corporations. So we got the analysis. We know what's going on. We just need to integrate it into our strategy. Not only do we fight back on the streets, but we can fight back in other ways. And I think that our consumer base is strong enough that we can send a strong message.
Absolutely. And so that message is through this consumer action, as Latasha Brown, co-executive director of Black Voters Matters, describes it. This consumer action that is running from today or yesterday all the way through Cyber Monday. And it's focus on local business, focus on small business, on Black business, immigrant business, woman business, business, LGBTQ, AI plus folks, businesses, like folk, disabled folks, like focus on the folks who actually need to be centered, who are under attack in this moment, and make sure that we are building those up. And so, hope folks will get more information, dig deeper into that, because it's a very easy on-ramp into the superhighway of liberation that all of us are trying to be on. Speaking of that, want to talk about what is happening. And we had a court hearing for another one of our comrades, David Huerta. I think it's important that people, remember that these cases against protesters are still happening. Of course, David Huerta is one of the more famous and one of, the ones that sort of has a certain level of support. We know that there are many others that are in court right now, being pressured to take plea deals, being prosecuted by the feds, not, some by the city attorney and the district attorney, but some actually by the federal government. And I think it's important that we pay attention to what's happening in David Huerta's case, but, and also look at what's happening with these other cases. I know that you have been paying attention yourself, Victor. Any updates or comments
so,
you have?
So one thing that Brother David does make it clear when he's out in public is not to forget that he's one of many cases that have been filed. I mean, we have a crazy U.S. prosecutor in Los Angeles who's like the typical best example of a MAGA prosecutor, and he's throwing frivolous charges all over the place. We really support David. You're going to continue to fight. You're not going to give in and continue to fight. Go to court, go to trial. Many of these cases are getting dismissed. Judges are dismissing them left and right because they're frivolous charges. The rate of grand juries refusing to indict under this president is historic. Usually, it's very small percentage of time that the grand jury refuses to indict. Under this president, they really, every time they're filing these frivolous cases, they are not getting any grand jury indictments. They have the most incompetent team of lawyers at the Department of Justice. And I think the good people who don't want to prosecute are getting fired. This is the authoritarian playbook of of Project 2025 is to take over the Department of Justice and make it your own private law firm. And that's what this president has done. But I praise the good people in the Department of Justice who have resigned, who refused to be part of it. But now he's got incompetent people just trying to harass, trying to come up with all these frivolous charges. And I think we just need to continue to keep fighting. We are winning in federal court. Every day is a federal court order against them. The issue, though, it becomes the threat to democracy is he's refused to comply with many of these federal court orders. So what do we do next? I mean, that's a crisis that Project 2025 talks about. You take over the government, you create the constitutional crisis. You make the Constitution meaningless, like the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment. So we need to realize what he's doing is the playbook of Project 2025. We need to come up with our own playbook on how to fight back against his authoritarianism and win back our democracy. But then create the kind of society that Peter and others fight for, a society where we all are treated with equity, dignity, and respect, and we all have affordable housing and good jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the work that Pete White is doing is and LA CAN does, the work that you do, that Baji does, like all of it, even KPFK, right? The work of having us on, giving us a space to have this conversation is all a part of it. And as you were talking just now, I was thinking about the about Kristen Noem and about how she has sent another flight of our folks, body snatch them from Venezuela body snatch some folks from Venezuela into El Salvador. And the judge is like, hey, didn't I already tell you that you can't do that anymore? And so there is more that needs to be done. And I think, what I like about this, we ain't buying it. What I like about some of the work people are doing in terms of, reaching out to electeds, also supporting people directly, right, in community defense, blowing whistles and doing all kinds of things, is there's so many ways that we have to lift up our voices, but we need to do that. We're going to have to engage, because it's not going to, they're not going to just follow court orders. We are going to have to engage.
Our best weapon is creativity and solidarity. We're very creative at our best, and we come up with all these kinds of different strategies. And it's like what National Day Labor Organizing Network and they did with the Home Depot, that buy-in, that use the ice scraper to bring down the corporate giant. That's creativity and solidarity. And I think I want to thank Pete for reminding me of that today. But, the solidarity between us got to really be, we have to mean it, right? We have to apply it on the streets. So if you're an immigrant being targeted by ICE or kidnapped, or you're an unhoused person being targeted by LAPD and harassed by LAPD, we have to be in a fight for both. Like an attack to one is an attack on all of us,
Absolutely. And that's why I like to talk about the body snatchers, right? And they will use people. It doesn't really matter the title at this point. They have collapsed the line between criminal punishment cops and prosecutors, jails and prisons, immigration enforcement cops and ICE and CBP, and the National Guard, so the military, that line is also being collapsed just to create this body snatcher force that, authoritarianism needs in order to function. And at the same time, I think we, as you've pointed out, that we're seeing people push back and make those connections. I think, for example, when Pete was talking about the building of the convention center and how some of the developers and other folks and, construction folks, et cetera, who may be working on that are also the same that work on detention prisons. We need to make those connections, particularly with labor, that has all of these Black and brown folks, many of them immigrants, to say, hey, wait a minute, what's happening here? How do we make that not occur? And we only got a couple of minutes, but I definitely want to take a minute to hear your thoughts on that, Victor.
Yeah, there's always contradictions in social justice work that we always have to not sweep under the rug. We have to confront it, analyze it, and have good discussions. And I think this is one area that merits a discussion. But also in other areas, because the elephant in the house as a city is the LAPD budget. We finally have to confront the reality that the LAPD budget drains the city. It takes away resources that we can use for other services, for other needs. We have to confront that and have a deep, thoughtful analysis because, I think militarization is being used in so many ways to harm communities in so many different spaces today in cities and in other communities. And we don't, the Trump administration is really showing what an authoritarian government looks like in right. the use of the military. So we need to really come out. We have to confront these issues before us and have some deep dialogue within us as social justice activists.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much. Appreciate you, Victor. Really appreciate you. Have a wonderful rest of your evening. We'll have you back.
Thank you so much, Nana. You take care. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's our show. I'd like to thank our guests. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, and assistant producer, Gary Scott. Remember to find ways to be well in the midst of it all. One love.
sisters and brothers on the day of mourning.